warm hands, I can hardly wait to hear what I've got to say. Well, I'll tell you, before I get up here, I make three damn good talks. The one I make before I get up, the one after I sit down, the one you make for me. And I've got another one. My wife makes one. She, you should have said this, and you should have said that, but hell, I can't remember. I'm like old Bob Smith there. I can remember and tell you what happened 54 years ago when I came into AA, but I can't remember what I had for breakfast. At my age, I don't even buy green bananas, I'll tell you that. You may get old someday, though, don't worry about it. Thank you for being here. And I understand you hauled Bob Smith around a while back, sometime back, some 25 years ago. And he, as Bob said today, he had an old Dodge broken down, and now he's got those big Lincolns. And you talk about your tail laughing. Mine laughed all the way around yesterday. We were driving us around. My name is Cersei, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cersei.
By the grace of God and the help of all of you people, Al-Anons, Al-Ateens, Al-Tots, Al-Tor, and in between, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since May 10th, 1946. And I'm deeply grateful. I can assure you the only reason, I mentioned the length of my sobriety is because I'm damn proud of it. That's the only reason I mentioned it. It could have been a lot worse. You know, I was raised out in West Texas and on a farm, and we had a lot of old cows, and I had the milk, which I damn sure didn't like, I'll tell you that. But I had the milk, and I remember those cold mornings. And I'd go out at the milk, and those old cows, one of them turned around and said, "Thank you for those warm hands." And thank you for your warm hands today. Those of you who don't like baptismal service, you'd leave now. We baptized a whole bunch of them over the country, old Bob and I. We go around spreading the disease. And, and he carries the message, and I spread the disease, okay? thank you for being here, Bob. And Bob getting around all over our local area. He used to worldwide. He spoke in Europe and Japan and everywhere else, you know. But he didn't do a lot of local speaking. And years ago, I remember, and nobody knew him because he came in 23 or 4 years ago. But since I started pimping for me, he's speaking every day and every night. You know, some important things that I think about today is our primary purpose. And it is so important if we look at history and what Bob talked about this morning. The history of Alcoholics Anonymous and the destiny of Alcoholics Anonymous depends upon our staying with the 12 traditions and carrying this message, trust God, clean house, and help others. You know, that was said a long time ago when Abby told Bill how he was staying sober in the Oxford group. And he said, "We trust God, clean house, and help others." And all the literature we have and all the knowledge we have and all everything we know through AA and our booklets and pamphlets and all that, the bottom line still is trust God, clean house, and help others, right? And we have to keep it that way. If we don't, we'll be dissolved one of these days, like something like Bob talked about, the Washingtonian movement, where they had 300,000 members at one time, and just started promoting their leaders, and some of them got into marriage counseling. We don't do that, you know. Well, we do some other things that might be up, but what they did was they didn't stay with their primary purpose, and they went out of business. And along came the Oxford group, and they had four absolutes. And Bob quoted you those four absolutes this morning, absolute honesty, absolute purity, and all. And Bill Wilson told me one time, I asked him, why didn't we have some four absolutes somewhere in the AA program? He said, an alcoholic can't absolutely do anything. And I agree. I'm going to pull this coat off. The only reason I'm wearing it, I just wanted you to know I've damn sure got one. Carl Sandburg said a long time, whenever a society or civilization perishes, there is always one condition present. They forgot where they came from. And if we ever forget where we came from, we'll perish. And that's the reason, when I sit, I'm in the presence of Bob Smith, there's something in my feeling that of gratitude. He's the only living person that it was there when it all started. The only one. Can you imagine that in our fellowship show me some old-time organization where there's only one left that knows what happened. Not very many. But we know what happened, and because Bob is able to give us that information and direct from the horse's mouth, that's exactly the way it happened. And that's the reason it's important. There's a lot that, I'll tell you another thing. I've got three important numbers in my life, and these are not my measurements. I'm 90 years old. I've been married to the same woman 65 years, and I've been sober 54 years. And I've won several, just recently I won a beauty contest. It rained and nobody got there but me. if we don't have fun and sobriety, we're not going to stay sober. There has to be some way that we find happiness and content and joy and peace of mind without alcohol, or we're not happy, joyous and free. But I'm happy today, and the sun shines bright. Everything is lovely. And I want to thank you people for making it that way, for all of wherever you live, wherever you come through, each one of you. And I want you to remember this. Each one, you may think you're not important, but you damn sure are. You are the only one that can help somebody and save their life. Each one of you, you, or you, or you. You say, well, I'm not important. If I don't stay sober, that thing's going to go on and be the same. It's not. You are. You're the only one that somebody, somewhere, some way will meet you. And if you have the message and you're still sober, and you can tell them what happened to you, that contacts. And it makes sense, and it happens. And that's the beauty. I want to read what Bill said way back there. Perhaps this is not the time or place to talk at length of my own recovery, of our AA program in detail, or of our... You know, our stories are sacred to us because that's what happened. But it doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you, only I drank in one bar, and you drank in another bar, and you drank in another city, and another city, and this and that, but we all wound up in the same boat. Powerless over alcohol, lives unmanageable. So we're all gathered here because we need to help each other, and we need to carry this message to those who still suffer. And there are millions out there. There are millions out there on the street and walking around just like I was, wondering, what the hell would you do if you didn't drink? And that's what I'm wondering. How could you live without drinking? I couldn't envision that, because I live in West Texas, and everybody drank out there, preachers, all of them. Everybody. Stayed drunk. So, I was raised on a farm out in Jones County, out Anson, and I saw a gal here last night from Hamlin, Rotan. I'm sorry, I mispronounced where you're from. But I'm sure you all know those places. They're such large places. Some of them 15 or 20 population and such big cities, you know. But I was raised in Funston. That's 6 miles east of Anson. It's right close to Hawley and Nugent and several little large cities like that. And I was raised on a farm, and there was seven in our family. My father and mother were devout Baptists, missionary Baptists, I'll have you know. And I'm a recovering Baptist, too. But on that farm, as bad as I hated it, and I hated every bit of it, I heard things from my dad that after I recovered from my drinking, that I remembered and I never forgot it. And my dad used to, on Sunday nights, he would have a prayer meeting, and he'd pray for his neighbors that I knew damn well he didn't like. But he'd pray for them. God bless old so-and-so. I know he's doing wrong, but God bless him. And he'd ask that God take care of him and things like that. So later on in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could visualize and I knew what he was talking about. And so I learned that, but it never meant anything to me as many other things until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, anyhow, I wanted, my mother used to say that I was more of a planter than I was a farmer. I planted it and hoped to hell it didn't grow, you know. That's the kind of a farmer I was. I didn't care anything about it, but finally I got off that farm, went up to Stamford, Texas. Now I'm getting into big cities, you know. Hot is hot in here.
It is.
But I had an old aunt that had a boarding house up in Stamford, and she said, come live with me and finish your high school. And that just suited me, a boarding house. What the appetite I had was, it was real good, you know. I finished high school there in Stamford, and the day I finished high school, I had a contract to play semi-pro baseball in the old West Texas League in Midland. And at that time, big oil companies and various large institutions, mainly oil companies, would sponsor baseball teams. And some of you have been along that line. And these farm clubs and so forth. And some of our players out there went on to the big leagues. And not me. But they gave us a job. We were supposed to work some along with playing baseball, and they gave us a salary. And they gave me a job with a big motor company there. It had the Dodge and Plymouth agency from Abilene to El Paso. And here's how you become an alcoholic. The way I did. I started drinking things, and suddenly alcohol gave me some things that I wanted. It gave me everything that I desired. I even got good looking drinking. Woo! Talk about improvement, working, that's it. And so I followed that route. From the time I started drinking, I drank heavily, and a lot of it. And I stayed upright for most of the time, for many years. I always hated to drink with a sorry drinker, though. Didn't you? You know, somebody would take a drink or two and say, oh, I don't like the taste of that stuff. And like my wife, she'll buy one of those grasshoppers, and we'll finish having dinner, and the salt's still on the top. Just a waste of money. drink it up, puke it up, and drink some more. Get sick and show them you can handle it, you know. The hell I can't handle it, just watch it. So, anyhow, our baseball manager was a guy named Doc Ellis in Midland, and he had a funeral parlor. And that's a hell of a combination, isn't it? A baseball manager and a funeral director. Well, every Sunday we'd go to the funeral parlor and celebrate having lost most of the time. And this Sunday night, we had a guy named Red Hill that played third base on our team. And Red was a sorry drinker. He'd drink a little bit and pass out, you know, and he was very degraded to our form of drinking and my idea of what a real drinker should be. And anyhow, this night he had a couple of beers, homebrew. We drank homebrew. And there's a homebrew face, one or two back there. And it's made out of chili and cornbread and this and that. And you ferment it and it'll make you drunk. That's all I know about it. But it sure will make you drunk. It'll make you lose all your problems and everything and damn sure lose you, you know, if you keep it up. Well, anyhow, Red passed out on the floor. And we indignant people who were good drinkers decided we'd get even with him. And we picked him up and put him in a casket. And we folded his arms and we stood back drinking, acting silly to wait what Red would have to say, if anything, if he waked up. And finally he waked up and he fell to the side of the casket and he looked all around, looked up and down. And then we heard him say, "If I'm not dead, why am I here?" And he said, "If I am dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom?" I think Red came into the program later on. I think he's one of our early members. You know, in the business they put me in, they made me general manager of this large company, and I did a lot of entertaining. Now, when you entertain, you've got to have a lot of whiskey, and you've got to do a lot of entertaining if you want to get business. And that's the way I did. I loaded that car up, and I entertained. Boy, did I entertain. And but what happens to you if you have that X factor in your life, and you keep drinking alcohol in large doses, some of us, somewhere down the line, cross that line into compulsive, pathological drinking. And that's the only kind of drinking that's a disease, compulsive, pathological drinking. You have to drink to get away from the effects of drinking. And that's where I got. And the further I went down, and then you wonder, what the hell happened? I used to handle alcohol. I used to entertain. I used to do this. And now, and you lose your self-esteem. You lose your family. You lose this and that. And you keep. And what I did, then I got fired from that, and I started working for a bunch of narrow-minded employers. Yeah, a lot of them narrow-minded as hell. You could drink and stay drunk for a week or so and come in, they won't know where you've been. None of their business. They're just paying you, that's all, you know. None of their, but the degrading effects of uncontrolled drinking leads into a lot of things that we don't want to be, but we're there. And the process of being there is all the same for all of us. We kept drinking for different reasons, but we kept adding out, and we had to have more alcohol, and the alcohol made a more dismal effect on our lives as we went along the way, right? And we developed alcoholism. So, I started taking the geographical cure. That's unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I went to Corpus Christi, Texas. They made me a credit manager of the old Packard Motor Company. Many of you never saw a Packard, but they're long old. Bob had one time. He said, "They're about as half as long as this room and as sorry as the ones I had, the ones we sold." And they made a 6 and an 8. And they furnished me with an 8 cylinder. And I'd load that thing up with whiskey and go out on the King Ranch. And you talk about being lonely, you go out there and drink, and the only way you can keep from being lonely and getting lost is to drink. But I was on a very strict diet. I'd eat nothing but cheese and crackers. And you get a lot of vitamins out of that, you know. So I said, "I want you to go home, and you keep coming back as often as you can to our meetings, and then you'll get some groups organized out there." And so I went back, and sure enough, I had all kinds of problems. I'd lost everything. And but what he told me, every time I think about taking a drink or going, then that's cool. You can't take a drink today. You know, that's a slick way we have. If you don't drink today, you never will drink. Because I thought, well, when tomorrow I got here, that's today, so I couldn't drink. So it had a slick way of moving me in that thing, you see. So After a while, to make a long story short, if that's possible, after a while, we got some groups together. And first we started a little group in Lubbock in September of 1946. And then we helped start three or four little towns around there. Would be one or two people that had gotten a big book or something and met not over two or three in each one. But we all came together and we kept working together, and AA mushroomed in that country. It just grew like nobody's business from the start out there. And so in 1946, we had the first state conference of AA in Austin, Texas, at St. Edward University, and I went down there, and Bill Lois Wilson came down to that convention. It wasn't a convention, it was a big crowd there. We had about 25 people. But I hung on to Bill, and somehow he clung to me for some reason, I don't know why. And we had a form of friendship that lasted until he died, a very close friendship. But he told me some things and he said, I'll be your sponsor if you'll let me. I said, my God, the guy that founded all this thing was he and Dr. Bob, and he wanted to be my sponsor. That is something. So anyhow, he regretted it later, but he did. We made some mistakes in those days. Like Bob was talking this morning, in the early days of AA, the early workings of AA, especially in West Texas, we had a hard time out there because we did things wrong. We had a guy that came down from Kansas City, and we elected him secretary of our group, and he ran off with the money. And Jim set up a deal here, and he stole the money, and Jane was doing something wrong, and this and that and the other. We had problems. And we were moving along, and this was our program. Let me read you how we were doing things then. And these are the 12 steps that we had before, the real 12 steps, the ones we were practicing. We admitted we were powerless over nothing, that we could manage our lives perfectly and those of anyone who would allow us to. We came to believe there was no power greater than ourselves, and the rest of the world was insane. We made a decision to have our loved ones and friends turn their will and lives over to our care, even though they couldn't understand us at all. We made a searching and fearless moral and immoral inventory of everybody we knew. We admitted to the whole world at large the exact nature of everybody else's wrong. We were entirely ready to make others straighten up and do right. We demanded others to either shape up or ship out. We made a list of all persons who had harmed us and became willing to go to any length to get even with all of them. We got direct revenge on such people wherever possible, except when to do so would cost our lives and at least a jail sentence. We continued to take the inventory of others, and when they were wrong, we promptly and repeatedly told them about it. We sought through bitching and nagging to improve our relations with others that we couldn't understand them at all, asking only that they knuckle down and do things our way. Having had a complete physical and emotional and spiritual breakdown as a result of this step, we tried to blame it on others and get sympathy and pity in all our affairs. That won't work. That won't work. But here we had the early promises, too. And we clung to these early promises, and they were so true. And they're like this, 12 of them. You'll know your full name and address. You'll be able to shave yourself. You'll be able to dress and undress yourself at the appropriate time and places. You will at all times know the city, state, and country you're in. You will routinely be able to find matching socks. That helped me. I used to wear a brown and blue sock. Drunk, you know, dressing in the dark. You'll be able to smoke if you wish through that burning hole in your clothes or the furniture. You'll lose the fear of food. You'll spend less time in the bathroom. You'll be able to walk a straight line past the balloon test. You'll lose the fear of police cars in your rearview mirror. You'll be able to answer the door without looking through the keyhole first. You'll realize what a mess you've been and thank God for AA and Al-Anon. You know, along those, this terrible thinking is, you know, we got the serenity prayer. Well, I had the senility prayer. God grant me the senility to forget the people I never liked anyway, the good fortune to run into the ones I do, and the eyesight to tell the difference. But the real 12 rewards of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are these: faith instead of despair, courage instead of fear, hope instead of desperation, peace of mind instead of confusion, real friendships instead of loneliness, self-respect instead of self-contempt, self-confidence instead of helplessness, a clean conscience instead of a sense of guilt, the respect of others instead of their pity and contempt, a clean pattern of living instead of a purposeless existence, the love and understanding of our families instead of their doubts and fears, the freedom of a happy life instead of the bondage of an alcoholic obsession. And those are the real rewards if we experience those 12 steps in order. How do I know? From the beginning, Dr. Bob and Bill put this thing together as best they could, and Bill had 100 drunks sober, the first 100 in AA in New York, and 25 of those 100 were agnostics, some atheists. And Bill told me that they met, and everyone, the agnostics, all for months and months and months, we admit we're powerless over alcohol, our lives are unmanageable, yes. But where do we go from here? And they had the Oxford group, the history of that. They had the Washington, and Bill had researched all of those to find out what happened. But when they kept meeting and they were not, said, what do we do? We'll go to each other and admit our faults and this, that, and the other, but we couldn't clean house. So what happened? We wouldn't have AA if it weren't for the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then we could experience those other steps. And as a result, it worked. It worked from the beginning. And if we look back at all these things that happened and how grateful and how thankful I am for Dr. Bob, Bill, and Ann, and Lois, and all the things they did. If you don't think it's lonely, try to have a meeting with just two of you guys or gals. And you think about Bob and Bill back there when they didn't have any 12 steps, they didn't have a damn thing, but they met, and you know the reason they stayed with it? They wanted to help somebody else. And that's the reason it worked. Their bottom line was, if we keep doing this is good, and we know what didn't work, so let's do things that will work. And all the things they did, they took out the things they knew would not work, and they put what would work, nobody sat down and wrote these 12 steps. No. They did those things, and as a result, they stayed sober. They experienced those things and stayed sober. So it worked from the beginning. And finally, all those agnostics of the 25 there finally agreed there must be some kind of power greater than we are. And I know we're down the line, the early days, we used the group as our higher power and this and that and the other. We had all kinds of higher power. And what happened is, like Bob said today, was that each one of us came to believe in a power greater than ourselves as you understand that power, thank God. And there's not anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous say, I don't want to hear that God business. Well, you don't hear it if you want to. But believe in some kind of power that's greater than, and I see those examples that I know there's a power greater than we are every day. And one of the most prominent ones of those in my memory is the birth of a little baby. that little baby comes out of the lady's womb, and the doctor spats it on the butt, and it comes to life. Could we do that? No. There's got to be some kind of power greater than we are that does these things. Look at a sunflower patch or whatever you want to out there. The same number of roses on each bush, isn't that? And look at those things, and look at the sky and how the sun sets and the moon comes up. All these, I have examples every day, and I have to look and see and be sure I know that there's a power greater than we are, and that power is absolutely there all the day and always there. You know, I make a commitment early in the morning not to drink just for 24 hours. And I turn my will and life over to the care of God in the morning at 7 o'clock. And about 10:30, I take it back. I get on the freeway, and a lot of signals out there, you know. And I take my will and my life back, and I also take the will and lives of other people back, you know. All of them. You spread the disease, you know. So, anyhow, in 1948, Bill Wilson came here. We had a little group that started all over that West Texas. And Bill Lois came to Lubbock. We had a big convention, about 25, 30 people. And I met Bill Lois and Amarillo, and we got on a plane, went on toward Lubbock. And those people wanted to see how Bill's wings flopped. You know, they'd never seen Bill. So Bill reached in his pocket on the way down, and he pulled out some handwritten notes. And I want you to read these and see what you think about them. Well, you know, that I'd been in a couple of years, and I knew damn well everything, almost, not quite, but nearly everything. And I looked them over carefully, and I handed them back to Bill, and I said, well, this is all right for you Yankees, but we don't need it down here. And he didn't say it, he just took it back. What it was the 12 traditions. Aren't you glad I didn't start this thing? Woo! Lord, the very thing that saved us. And the reason it saves is because Dr. Bob Bill researched all these. What happened that they went out of business? What happened that their institution went out of business? They perished. Why? Because they didn't stay with their primary purpose. And it'll happen to us, and that's the reason we have the 12 traditions. And out in the West, that Western country, we're the cause of needing the 12 traditions worse than anywhere else in the world. We broke every kind of tradition you ever heard of, if there had been any, you know, and that's the reason Bill started working on it. We had to make sure that these things don't happen to us, and we will always have AA, and that's the reason we have the 12 traditions. It assures us that we will always have AA, provided that we will adhere to those principles of the tradition. So it works. Anyhow, down the line, long about that same time, I asked Bill a lot of silly questions. I want to know about his spiritual experience. I want to know all about this and that and the other, about his looking into these other organizations, all that stuff. He said, why in the hell don't you go to Yale School on alcohol studies and learn all these things? He said, you're so inquisitive. I said, I'll go. How do I go? He said, I'll send you. And to get rid of me, he sent me up there. And you talk about knowledge. Old Dr. Jelinek was head of the Yale School in New Haven, and they studied alcoholism from one end to the other, and that's the reason we have alcoholism as a disease. Dr. Jelinek promoted that idea, and it's absolutely true. So, anyhow, I went up there and got baptized. I learned all about alcoholism, and they gave me one project working in the research department of working with mice. And they gave me a cage of mice. And they said, you can make alcoholics out of mice. Now, I'd never heard of that. I never heard of an alcoholic mouse. And so, anyhow, I took that project on. And we started out with, they had a shrill whistle in this cage. There were about 40 mice in there. And they'd had water in there. And those mice would be drinking out of the water. You could blow that whistle, and they'd just tear that cage up, just run on it, do that, go crazy. And we started giving them alcohol over dosage over here, and kept giving it to it. And finally, down the end, you could blow that damn whistle all you want to, and that mouse sit there and just keep drinking. just like we did, you know. And I found out that mice should be alcoholic too, so I'm real fortunate to have all that experience and knowledge. And I came back to Dallas, and a lot of things happened. My experiences and how these things happen, and I thought I knew it all, but I needed to learn a lot of things. Well, anyhow, about a year later, Dr. Jelinek, who was head of the Yale School on Alcohol Studies, was originally a banana scientist down in South America, and they hired him up at Yale University to do research on alcoholism, and he did a hell of a job, as you know. And I asked him one day, how in the world did you go from bananas to alcoholic? He said, they're just alike. They get away from the bunch, they get peeled. So, in 1950, Dr. Jelinek became ill. And he had moved his school from New Haven to TCU at Fort Worth. And another guy and I worked out of that institution there at TCU for a couple of years doing alcoholism studies and alcoholism information. We got local committees on alcoholism and so forth. In 50, Dr. Jelinek became ill and retired. And he said, Searcy, the greatest need we have in this country is hospitals where an alcoholic can go and sober up and where members of Alcoholics Anonymous come in and help them and take them to meetings and sponsor them, and they can stay sober. And so that's what we did. We established a hospital in Lubbock and in Dallas and Houston. Had one right here out on Westheimer Street out there, and one in Carlsbad, New Mexico. 75% of those who, and they were all just alcoholics then, and 75% of those stayed sober. Not because of the hospital, because AAs came in there and helped them and took them to meetings and sponsored them and told them how to stay sober on a daily basis, and it worked. And those AAs that helped, that came in there and worked with it, they're the ones that stayed sober. You know, now the treatment centers, they keep them 30 days, and we don't go out, they do our 12-step work. I need to see a fresh drunk, and I ask God every morning, show me somebody today that needs help as badly as I did. And a lot of days I'm showing that person, somebody, like old Scott Dillon that talked about when we first met. And I need to see that live alcoholic. I need to see somebody practicing alcoholism, and I can see myself. And it's the greatest thing that ever happens to me is to know that maybe some guy or gal that you talk to, maybe they'll see the light and be able to sober up and stay sober. So, in that hospital in Dallas, in 1953, Bill Wilson came to Dallas to visit. He wanted to see the hospital. And we had a nice hospital, and it had a lot of medical directors in there and people that help us, medical doctors. And Bill went in there and visited with every one of the patients. There were about 15, and he talked with every one of them. And we went to have lunch at the Melrose Hotel, and another guy and Bill and I were there. And I asked Bill, I said, Bill, a lot of things have happened in AA over the last many years. What would you rather see happen than anything that's ever happened? He said, without a doubt, he said, I'd like to see Abby have a chance to get sober. Now, for the 40th time, Bill Wilson was in Towns Hospital for drunk alcoholism. And in came an old school buddy, old Abby. And Bill said, Abby was in the Oxford group. And Bill, talking to Abby, he said, what's this religion you've got? Well, he said, it's not religion. Well, what do you do? And he quoted those four absolutes and those things. And then he said, well, what's the bottom line? Bill asked him. He said, trust God, clean house, and help others. Trust God, clean house, and help others. So Bill that night got on his knees and said, if there is a God, show himself to me. And he had that spiritual experience. And God showed himself, and he never took another drink. And he's the cause of us being here alive today, part of it, he and Dr. Bob. So, how those things happened to me is the grace of God. And so we tried to get in touch with Abby. Abby, 6 months after he told Bill what to do, he went down on the Bowery in New York and started drinking again and lived down there for 9 years until 1953. And so when Bill said that, he had an idea. He looked at me and said, take care of Abby. He might as well have said that. I knew what he meant. Well, we got Abby down there, and he sobered up. He stayed sober 3.5-4 years at a time, several times. And in the meantime, you know what we do, a lot of us, some of us, not very many, but we give up on somebody. And old Abby had been in the hospital there, and his room was right across from my office. And every morning he'd come in and cuss me out, and the next morning he'd cut Dr. Bob, and the next morning Bill. Abby could have been one of our co-founders. He took the message to Bill, what, trust God, clean the house, and help others. And he went and got drunk. Bill got sober. That's the difference. But Bill always said that Abby was his sponsor because he told him what to do in the first place and how to get sober, what to do. So he was his sponsor. Well, Abby, I'll tell you, he was very bitter. And I could understand he was very resentful and that he didn't stay in there and be one of the co-founders with Dr. Bob and Bill. But he didn't do it. But he finally, after about a month there, I called Bill, and Bill, we had agreed to give him a round-trip ticket. If he didn't like it, well, he could go back to New York and go back to the Bowery. And I called Bill, and I said, I'm getting ready to ship Abby back because he's not improved. He's cussing me out and running everybody crazy. And Bill said, hang on if you can and try to help him. And so I turned it over to somebody else. And this is where I'm talking about. You're the only one. I can't do it. But a nurse there, a registered nurse, said, let me try to work with Abby. And I said, you can have the SOB. I don't want it. Take it. Gladly. And she started, and about a week later, she came in and said, I see some changes in Abby. And I said, well, I don't see any, but I haven't been around him lately, so I don't know. And about a week later, he came in and said, where are you going? I said, I'm going over to the group. What group? I said, hell, you know what group. I'm going to AA. And he said, can I go with you? And he went over, and he stayed all afternoon. The next day, he went and stayed all day. And then a few days, we went to Lubbock, Texas, to a meeting out there. And he got up and said, my name is Abby Thatcher, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm damn glad to be back in AA. Somebody I gave up on. Somebody I didn't think would make it. But the grace of God, the sunlight of the Spirit shone in. Not me, not us, but God's Spirit. If you're not as close to God as you once were, make no mistake about who moved. And if you're near or close to God, make no mistake about who should move. Because he's always there. And our whole life and our program, our sobriety, everything about it is contingent upon our relationship with God as of today, right now. Not yesterday, what happened in the past or anything about it. Right now. And my sobriety is every day, every hour, contingent upon how, if my relationship is good with God, I can get along with you and get along with everybody and have a happy, joyous, free way of living. But it's contingent upon my willingness to turn my will and life over to the care of God and leave it there, not take it back like I do a lot of times through the day. So, the way these things all happened is to me, is amazing. But you can see the threads of spirituality woven through all the fabric of AA. Look at Bill's experience and what Abby told him, and he had the spiritual experience. You know, I've had some hot flashes, but that could be my age. I don't. But a spiritual awakening is something we can understand. And like Bob said today, that's the change that we had in the program. Very few ever had a spiritual experience like that, a burning bush like Bill did. But it happened, and it happens to us so long as we experience those steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we will always experience those steps as they're written, because that's what they did, those who stayed sober from the beginning and those who stayed, said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men who share their experience, grief, and hope with each other that they solve their common problem. Some people may be not be able to have the program, but that program is always there, and we always need to be willing to help those that don't make it to begin with. And keep the doors of AA open. Keep the fellowship. You know, one of the greatest guys I've ever seen in AA, and you might try it if you're looking for service work. Whatever group you're in, go to that front door every night before the meeting and greet everybody and tell them you're glad they're there and if you can help them. If you want to do something. And that guy that I knew, Emory Richardson, he was later a delegate and went up to New York to our general service office. But he was at that door every night, and everybody that came in knew, oh, he found out if they were new, if they wanted to stay sober, whatever, and he talked to them, and a lot of them stayed sober. And he was very happy that happened. So, all of those things that happen that are good is by the grace of God, as far as I'm concerned. And that sunlight of the Spirit will always shine on us if we will observe and experience those 12 steps of Alcoholics. Now, I want to say a word about you young folks. You may think you're not important. You may think, well, I've just been in a short time. I don't know what to do. I'm not doing anything, and I don't know. Get busy. Do something. Get involved. And I want to tell you, I appreciate every one of you young people, because before long it's going to be in your hands. It's in there already. But you need to take the responsibility, and we're responsible to stay sober and to help other people. And I've heard Bob quote this poem several times of what happened, and this to me is the same position that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous today. In World War II, there were 200,000 soldiers of ours killed in Flanders Field. They were all murdered. But they wrote a poem, somebody there, that told about their feelings of having served their country and did their duty and did their job. And I see the likeness now in the young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you'll remember that poem, it goes something like that: in Flanders Field, the poppies grow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our places, and in the skies the larks still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amidst the guns below, we're the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, but now we lie in Flanders Field. Take up the quarrel with the foe, to you with failing hand we throw the torch. Be it yours to hold high. If you break faith with us who die, you shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Field. And to me, that's exactly like we're standing today in Alcoholics. Now, you people take up the thing and carry it on like you're doing now. And you've already doing it, and I appreciate it so much, all of you who are doing that. I told you, sometime back there, a while back, that I went to Stanford High School and finished high school. And there was a guy in there finished high school the same time I did, and he was the son of a Methodist minister, and therefore I didn't think much of it. He wasn't a Baptist, you know. So Stuart Hamblin was the guy's name. And he wrote a lot of religious and a lot of spiritual songs. And a lot of them are still around. And 2.5 years before, he wrote all the religious songs for religious movies. And so I talked to him many times, and finally he called me, and I was his sponsor. He came into AA 2.5 years before he died. But he wrote that, I told him I thought he wrote this song for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you'll remember it is no secret what God can do. And it go, don't leave, I'm not going to sing it. But I'm going to quote the words, and it, this means a lot to me. The chimes of time ring out the news, another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength, your courage to renew. Do not be disheartened, because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. There is no night, for in His light you'll never walk alone. You'll always feel at home wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take Him at His promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. What He's done for others, He'll do for you. With arms wide open, He'll pardon you. It is no secret what God can do. So that song is in my heart, and that and AA to me go together. And I want to thank you folk for your workers here, the people who put this on. You did a hell of a job. Continue to do so. It's a great thing that you did here in bringing us all together for our primary purpose that we must stay with, trust God, clean house, and help others. And stay with our primary purpose always, and we'll always have AA. So I challenge each and every one of you today that we abandon ourselves to God as we understand God. Clear away the records of the past. Admit our faults to our fellows. And I have no doubt that all of us, somewhere, some way, sometime, will meet again. And until then, God bless all of you, and I love all of you. Thanks so much.